Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. Where does your curiosity lead you? For today's guest, Paul Nylander, his curious nature has taken him from the world of high-energy physics to book design as he searches to understand how everything works. Paul is a book designer, engaging storyteller, and owner of Illustrata, a studio that collaborates with small presses and independent authors to get their ideas into the world. In our conversation, he shares his curious journey from physics to design. He also explores where his love for books comes from, the art and science of change, the nature of generalists and specialists, and the role of questions and trust in his design process. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/545.
That is the magic word, and it's what keeps things going. I think if I stopped being curious, I mean that's like the day I die. It's over at that point. And it's good because I never will satisfy it. So what am I endlessly curious about? The thing that really drives me is I want to know how it all works, and that's, you know. Could be mechanical. It could be, you know, how does society work? How does the internet work? You know, how does nothing in life, nothing that we experience is that way by chance. Everything is designed, if you want to use that sort of phrase to it.
Yeah.
And there's a reason it is the way it is. There's a reason why our society is all mixed up the way it is today. I'd like to know why. And so that's what I'm endlessly curious about. And that's why I'll never be satisfied because.
Right.
That's a big, big question.
Yeah.
But it drives everything I do. I mean, it really does.
Wow. I mean, when did you become fascinated with why things work the way they do?
Oh, I think I always have. I mean, I remember as a little kid, I would like disassemble things. Like my dad had this old reel-to-reel tape recorder, you know, back from when he was in the service. It was portable, but it was built out of plywood. I mean, the thing weighed 50 pounds. But I tore it apart. I mean, I completely disassembled the thing and put it back together.
Oh, wow.
It still functioned. But, you know, I just want to know what's inside the box. You know, what makes it go? What makes it work? How does it record? How does it play? And I have always been that way. I don't take things apart so much anymore. Now they're mostly small and you can't disassemble them anymore. But
that's right.
At least for electronics, but I'm always insatiably curious. You know, like if, you know, a road crew is out on the road, you know, digging a hole to fix a water main in the street. Yeah. I'm out talking to the crew because I'm like, so how does this work? You know, what do? How do you stop the water from coming out? I just want to know. I just want to know how it works.
Yeah. How do people respond to that curiosity for you?
You know, usually it's pretty good because you're asking them about what they're doing. And everybody loves to talk about what they're doing. I mean, otherwise you'd be out of a job here, Chris, if that wasn't the case.
That's true. You'd be surprised. Some people don't like talking about what they do.
Most people, I think, though, do. And you know, like so the road crew example, I mean, actually that literally did happen a couple of years ago. And so awesome. It was across the street. A water main, or not the water main, but from the water main in the street to the house, somebody's line had broken. And the only way to fix it is you got to dig a big hole, get down there. It was the middle of the winter. There was ice everywhere. It was a mess, absolute mess. But I think that the workers are, you know, they're intrigued when somebody's curious about what they do because it's their job. It's what they do every day. And I'm like, I don't know how I'd fix a pipe in the middle of the winter 8 feet underground. I mean, I have no idea how to do that. Now I do. So should it ever come up, I'm all set.
should you get the call to fix the water pipe 8 feet down, you're ready.
Yes.
That's really interesting. Like how when you learn all of these things, the way things work, why they work, how do you bring that into what you do?
That's a less obvious answer. I think, so as a, at least it's what I do right now. So as a book designer, it helps to have an understanding of the subject matter to some extent. And, you know, whether that's time traveling science fiction aliens or someone's personal memoir about their experience in World War II. I mean, it's not things that I can personally have done, you know, because that's the point of writing a book and sharing books is that, you know, you get to learn from somebody else's life, from somebody else's experience or ideas. But having a kind of an inclination of how to get from where I am, point A, to where they are, point B, you know, if I have a few steps along that road, that makes it much easier for them to meet me in the middle and or maybe closer to their side. So I think, you know, understanding how things work kind of helps in that regard. But that's honestly not why I do it. I just do it because I'm just really curious about how things work.
Well, I love that you mentioned books because I love reading. I love books. I love everything about a book, from the typography to the way it's laid out, why some books are easier to read than others. And I'm curious when you first got interested in books.
Well, books are one of those things I think that I've been lucky enough to always be around to some extent. I mean, I always remember having books as a kid, but I'm actually not a very good reader. I'm not a very fast reader or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The books that I mainly enjoy are, especially as a kid, but even now actually, are nonfiction. I read some fiction, but mostly it's nonfiction. So as a kid, it was like technical manuals, and it was
that's awesome.
It was, you know, like science discovery, you know, popular science kind of discovery books and things like that. You know, again, getting to this, you know, understanding how everything works. You know, it was probably junior high before I first read a book, which was nonfiction. It was a memoir. That was probably the first time, though, that I actually read a book where I was like, I could not put it down. I read the book cover to cover and really enjoyed the experience of it. It wasn't like a technical manual. It was, well, it's Jerry Spies's Alone Against the Atlantic. You probably can't even find it in print anymore. But it's this Minnesota guy, actually, who built this 10-foot sailboat in his driveway here in Minnesota, which, for the geographically disinclined, it's the middle of the continent. We're not near an ocean, any of them. But he built this sailboat, this 10-foot sailboat, trucked it out to the Atlantic Ocean, and his goal was to sail across the Atlantic Ocean by himself in a sailboat.
Wow.
Pre-GPS, pre-sat phone days, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was a fascinating story because, you know, some of it was technical. There was some stuff about how he actually built this boat. And what the research was that he did to, you know, it wasn't like he just, you know, took a little, you know, little aluminum craft and said, let's throw a sail on this and make it work. I mean, he actually researched this. It was a specially built boat just for this.
Wow.
You know, but it was also then the story of the journey and what he was dealing with and what it was like to be alone and the sounds of the sea and things like that. It was fascinating to me. That was a point that I started to understand books were more than just repositories of information.
Yeah.
You know, you could actually change people with books. Not that I then jumped into a book career immediately. It would be decades later before I did. But that book has stuck with me ever since then. I still have it around here somewhere. Somewhere.
Yeah.
I have a lot of books, so it's hard to know. But I'm pretty sure I still have it somewhere. Down on my biography shelf.
Well, I love that you've already classified your books so that you have a biography section.
Oh, yeah. My books are all categorical. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Librarians would be happy with my house.
I mean, do you abide by the Dewey Decimal System as well?
I do not do that. They're categories that make sense to me. That's somewhat to my wife's annoyance, but they're mostly my books, so that's the way it goes.
That's spectacular.
No, but as a designer, you know, I mean, designers are the greatest book collectors in the world. I mean, because there's always another book we want to read, even if it's something we already know how to do. Mm-hmm. We still want to hear somebody else's take on it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you know, just the books I have concerning design and typography and type design and book binding. And I mean, you know, that's a whole, you know, bookshelf right there.
Yeah.
So keeping those sensible and, you know, relatively accessible is a good idea.
Yeah, for sure. I'm feeling the urge to start categorizing my books right now, but I'll continue the interview. Don't worry. Don't worry.
Well, you can do it the Zoom way, which is by color, or you can do it, you know, in an actual topical way.
Right. So you talk about the story of, you know, the guy building a 10-foot boat in the middle of the continent. But when was the experience with an actual book where you were looking at the construction and the design of it that started to shift how you thought about books?
Oh, that happened much, much later in life, much more recently. So the irony of my life is that even though I love learning things, I am sometimes very myopic about things outside my current cone of vision, if you will. And, you know, like when I got into design, it was eye-opening to realize that people actually got paid to do design. I thought it was just something people did for fun at night, like I did. And partway through kind of training as a designer, it was exactly that same thing that I hadn't realized people designed books. They just showed up, I guess, or you know, somehow people had a program or something that did it. And it was kind of that discovery that books, like everything in life, actually are very purposefully designed and very purposefully constructed. That's when I started to become really aware of it. Hmm. And I was at the same time studying some book arts and hand book making and hand printing, letterpress printing, stuff like that. And it all kind of converged at the same moment. And that's when I really started to understand, you know, there's not just hardcover and softcover books in the world, but all the different ways you can bind a book, you know, and all the different reasons for doing that. Mm-hmm. And the ways that you can, you know, construct books to be beautiful objects in and of themselves rather than just, you know, something with a cover glued on and call it good.
Yeah.
And, you know, then in the design side of things, understanding what goes into the look and feel and purpose and intentionality of a book. So that all kind of hit me all at once. Hmm. Sort of a tidal wave kind of thing.
Yeah, as you're telling me about the way books are designed, I remember reading recently why nonfiction business books were the length that they were. I think at the time it was like 200 or 300 pages, and it's because it would make the spine big enough to where it could stand apart on the shelf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, you cannot publish a business book less than 150 pages, typically 180, you know, in a normal, you know, 6x9 kind of size. That's just, you know, nobody would buy a book smaller than that because they feel like it's not, I guess, authoritative enough, yeah. Which is really ironic, Chris, because if you think about it, you know, if business book costs what, you know, $14.95 or $19.95, something like that. If somebody could encapsulate everything you needed to know about a topic in, let's say, a 24-page booklet, wouldn't that actually be worth more than having right. to wade through 230 pages of their life history just to get to the point that you're trying to get to?
That's why podcasts exist.
Well, and it's one of those kind of odd things about publishing is that, you know, publishing is about creating books, and it's, you know, the art form, and it's writers and authors and, you know, the poetry of it all. But at the same time, it's also manufacturing a product. And that product's got to look right on the shelf or it isn't going to get bought.
Yeah.
That's kind of the darker side of it. But it is true, you know, and that's reality of it. I've done a lot of books like that where, you know, I'm working on them and it's, well, I shouldn't say this because my clients might hear this, but, you know, you look at it and say, this book could be shorter. But it can't be because that would be too short to market it. Yeah. And it would be too small of a spine.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And I, you know, I think for myself, when I think of the design of a book, sometimes I think of just the layout itself and the typography, but, you know, straight down to the way that you design the spine, there's so many different ways that a designer touches a book.
Oh, it goes deeper than that. I mean, you think about paper. Well, okay. Most people don't think about paper. It's the thing you grab out of the cabinet when the printer's out of it. Mm-hmm. But I spent a lot of time thinking about paper because paper comes in different thicknesses. It comes in different weights. It also comes in different thicknesses. And if you have a book that doesn't quite have enough spine, you can use a thicker paper.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, the kid that writes double-spaced papers in order to fill out their 10-page you know, assignment paper. You know, use big fonts. It's kind of like that, but it's more in a professional sense. Use thick paper.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, it's interesting, Paul, because when I learned about you and your journey before design, you started your journey studying physics and even receiving a PhD in experimental high energy physics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has to be a fascinating story alone right there.
It is the proven path to become a good book designer is to start with a PhD in high energy physics.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you mentioned a little
That's why it's so hard to get into the field. It isn't.
So you mentioned, you know, being curious about how things work. What is that what led you naturally to science?
It is to some extent. So back at that age, you know, where you have to make these kind of, you know, lifetime decisions, you know, right. In high school, I was the kind of student who would frustrate the teachers because I could absorb information very quickly. Mm. And they didn't really know what to do with me. Mm. And it was a time kind of before the advanced learning programs that they have now existed. And so it was, you know, it was a big challenge to figure out what to do with, you know, students like myself. Now, I certainly wasn't the only one. And so one of the big things that I was hit with in kind of that high school age is that science was always the thing that people thought was the hardest. Mm-hmm. And physics of the sciences was the one that people thought was the hardest of the sciences.
Yeah.
So I studied physics because I could. Why not study the hardest thing?
Yeah.
It's not that I didn't like physics. I mean, obviously, I spent 10 years post-high school doing it. Mm-hmm. Physics is a fascinating field, and the physics world is a fascinating world. But what really got me into it, I mean, was early curiosity in things like cosmology and, you know, like Stephen Hawking, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, which are certainly are physics, but that's not like day-to-day physics. Right. Physicists do not sit around like Stephen Hawking and think about, you know, how the universe works. Just like any profession, there's kind of the sexy side to it. And then there's the day-to-day doing of it.
It's kind of like social media.
Yeah. So physics is that same way. So really I got into it because it was a very hard subject that I could do. And it was the hardest classes I could take in high school. And so I did. And I did, you know, relatively well at it. And it does certainly get to the fundamental. I mean, of the sciences, physics is the most fundamental.
Right.
In theory, if you understand physics, you understand how everything works. At least that was the notion that I had at the time. And wanting to understand how everything works, it seemed like a pretty logical place to start. Start at the beginning, start at the fundamental. And so I went all the way fundamental, you know, to the most minuscule particles and start from there. Because if you understand electrons and quarks, you understand the building blocks of everything.
Yeah.
It turns out starting from the building blocks, it's a long ways to get all the way back up to understanding like how politics works. Electrons and quarks do not lead in a very easy way to that kind of an answer.
Wow. And did you get to an answer as you went from, you know, electrons and quarks?
No. And that's why things have changed, I think, for me throughout life. Because, you know, you get to a point where you realize you've kind of exhausted this line of questioning.
Oh.
And so you move on to something else.
Wow.
And for me in physics, that was kind of, you know, where I got to. You know, I had no disrespect or you know, or ill will toward the world of physics. I mean, there's things about it that I like a lot. There's things about it that I don't like. It was great work. It was a wonderful way to get through college. I paid my own way through college because I was able to work in the physics department the whole time. But it's also a very big industrial field, and there's a lot of money in it, and there's a lot of politics in it, and it can get very not fun when you start playing at that level.
Wow.
That sounds very dark. But the cool thing was, you know, like as an undergrad, I was working in high energy physics as an undergrad, which was pretty fascinating. And so I spent a lot of time in Germany, in northern Germany, in the town of Hamburg, where there's a high energy physics research facility. Got to spend a little bit of time at CERN, you know, the more well-known high energy physics facility that straddles France and Switzerland. And, you know, essentially on a all expenses university paid trip, you know, I mean, these are things that undergrads, you know, like 18, 19, 20 year olds, you don't get to do this kind of stuff. I mean, And I was doing it. It was my normal life. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I would not trade that for anything because, you know, that's the kind of opportunities that literally are once in a lifetime.
Yeah, for sure. And I love that you said you purposely went after the hardest things. I mean, is that naturally part of your character or was that something just because?
Oh, yeah. If there's a hard way to do something, I'll find it. You know, and I'm always about optimizing. I mean, I like to make things easier for other people, easier for myself.
Yeah.
But once you've done that, they're no longer interesting either.
Right.
You know, it's no longer a problem to solve. So yeah, I've always migrated toward the challenging kind of situations.
At what point in the story does design enter the picture?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. And I've thought about this more recently as I've been doing some branding work for, you know, for my design company and things is where exactly did it get started? And for me, it actually started very early before physics. I remember in junior high, taking what was then called graphic arts and learning, you know, a little bit about letterpress, which was certainly a dead technology at that point, learning about photo typesetting, which was very much a live technology at that point, you know, doing, you know, offset printing at a very small scale, things like that, and spending a lot of time doing photography. Photography has been a thread through my whole life as well.
Oh, neat.
I actually don't remember the lunchroom in my junior high school because I spent all my time up in the darkroom in the AV lab.
Yeah.
So the notion of at least the tools of design were there very early on, but they always tended to get shoved aside.
Right.
You know, in high school, again, you know, the way things are structured, you know, a student like me was not really allowed to take trade skill classes. You know, I wasn't allowed in the industrial arts wing of the school. Because, you know, I had this brain that could do physics. So, you know, you get ushered into the ivory tower. That's you know, the path for you. So I never really thought much of it. And, you know, I wasn't like, you know, the artistic students. I couldn't draw. I still can't really draw to save my life or anything. You know, in still life, oh my God, I mean, shoot me. I mean, I can't stand that kind of thing. But, you know, so some of the creative aspects were there, but they never really got a chance to be honed. But they continued to be there kind of my whole life. And, you know, things like even in college or in grad school, I mean, my lab reports were, I got to tell you, stunning to look at. They were well formatted. I understood, you know, fonts and formatting very early on.
Right.
Early Macintosh, certainly when that came around. And like in grad school, so you know, imagine this. So I'm here working on my PhD in physics. I'm taking classes, which are, I'll be honest, they're hard classes. You know, these are not for the faint of heart at all. They are meant to, you know, filter out the people that can't make it through the actual dissertation program. And in parallel with that, I'm the editor of the graduate newsletter, which is a print newsletter that's printed in black and one PMS color. And, you know, so I'm using, you know, the predecessor to InDesign, you know, PageMaker. And
yeah.
And, you know, I take photos and acting as photo editor and getting writers to write articles for this thing that comes out a few times a year. And it goes to all the graduate students. This is at Ohio State where I'm a grad student. You know, so it's got a circulation of 15,000 or something like that. I mean, this is what I do for fun. Nobody told me, you know, there's this whole graphic arts program and this is actually what they do. Because I guess they were off busy doing real things, and that left me in a room to do this silly little newsletter for the graduate school.
Wow.
But, you know, but so I learned about, you know, Pantone color chips while I was a PhD student. and they have nothing to do with one another, but it was a fun diversion.
Yeah.
So I always kind of had some of those rudimentary skills there, and they always came up. So after getting out of academia, I worked for a while as an electrical engineer, wrote a lot of software, ended up starting a business. selling electronic instrumentation and doing custom software application development for our clients. That was my day job. The night job for my own business, that was kind of like moonlighting for myself, was writing product brochures and doing our website. And that was just, again, it was the fun stuff. It was how you unwound at night, you know, getting out of the day stuff. So I had that business. This was a company called IMC DataWorks. I had that business for about a dozen years. And it was probably halfway through that stint that I was doing these brochures. We sold a product that was actually manufactured in Germany. Germans, great engineers, not terribly good creative people from the, you know, artistic standpoint, let's say. And so, at least not the engineers. So this company was founded by four brilliant, brilliant engineers. And they had these brochures, which were in German, which were not that strong. And they were translated into English, which didn't help them. And I just said, look, guys, I can't use these to sell to my market here. It's not going to fly. So I wrote my own. You know, I did all the writing. I did all the copywriting. I look back on them. They were terrible, but they were better than what I had. You know, so that was kind of the thing that I was doing. And it was one of those wake up moments that, you know, partway through doing that, you know, actually people get paid to do this. This is actually a profession. And as far as I can tell, it's kind of a fun one. So I kind of pivoted out of the instrumentation world and did more marketing and, you know, kind of this content marketing development. It was a really fascinating change. And it was, you know, kind of tapping into these things that I'd always kind of been doing anyhow.
It's really interesting because as I hear your story, what I'm hearing is your incredible ability to change without a whole lot of, I don't know, a lot of people can't make changes and pivot like you do.
See, I don't even see it that way. I mean, I was just doing what came naturally. You know, it's a problem. Go figure out a solution. But yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. Like I'm marveling at the fact that like I don't get the impression that you sat around going, well, should I do this or should I do this? Or, you know, what is the meaning of this route right here? It's just like, this is the problem. I'm going to go solve it and see what happens. I guess that's just the hallmark of curiosity right there.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds that way at the 10,000 foot view. You know, there is obviously a lot of self-questioning. And, you know, leaving physics was not an easy choice. I mean, it's like, okay, you just dedicated 10 years of your life and you're going to do what? That's basically what my professor said when I said I was leaving. So, but it, you know, it's, I think it's important. And I've been lucky to be able to follow my interests, you know, wherever they may lead. And they didn't always lead in the most logical or sensible way. But as it turns out, I guess I've got a thick enough skin that I can tolerate that, you know, 2-3-4 year transition period that it always takes to start in something new.
Yeah.
Having done it now, I guess twice.
Right. Well, I think what an amazing thing for people to take away from this part of the story is just that willingness to see through those difficult times of transition because you love what you're doing and you're so curious and driven to know more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I'm not a quitter, certainly by any stretch of the imagination. I will take things as well beyond where they probably should be taken. But I think it's also important to know that you can pivot.
Yeah.
And when it makes sense, for you, for me, you know, for whoever, when it makes sense, just do it. And see what happens.
Yeah.
It's funny because I remember talking to, especially back when I had the instrumentation business, talking to students in college and doing like mock interviews, you know, helping out the career services folks and things like that at the university. And, you know, students were just so laser focused on, oh, I got to get the job at this, you know, big corporate entity. You know, this is the pathway to fame and riches. And of course, you know, I'm here having bounced around amongst careers and things like that. And I'm just like, why? I mean, what really do you want to get out of it? Of course, it's a rhetorical question. Nobody in college can really answer that.
Right.
But I'm hoping at least I implanted the question in their minds so that at some point, you know, when they're working their 20-hour days in their tiny little cube without daylight, you know, they would be like, yeah, why am I doing this? and, you know, take whatever they learned in college and apply it somewhere, you know, do something with it. And that's always a funny question. You know, people are like, you know, well, should I get this kind of degree or not? You know, should I study this or not? I don't care. You know, get whatever degree you want. Get a degree. I think it's certainly worth getting. It's worth proving that you can complete something at that level, that you can work at that level. I mean, that is a notable hallmark. But specifically what it's in, I can give it 10 years, you'll probably be doing something different anyhow.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, there's that statistic out there that, you know, for you know, like, look at like kids in grade school or junior high right now, you know, the job they will have probably doesn't even exist yet. Mm-hmm. You know, the things are always changing and you have to go with the flow. I mean, it's going to be, you know, change is life. That's how things happen. Mm. That sounds much deeper than I actually am, but.
That's great though. I love it. Change is life. Now you know what the episode is going to be called.
There we go.
Oh my gosh. One of the things that I read on your site that just triggered a whole line of questioning was when you were tired of being a highly focused specialist. And I think there's an ongoing discussion in the creative world about what it means to be a generalist versus a specialist.
Yes.
And I'd love to know your thoughts on that, because being as someone who started hyper-focused and a specialist, as a hyper-focused specialist, there we go, it sounds like you've always been a generalist to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think that is a true assessment. I have always been a generalist. And yeah, a lot of it depends on your frame of reference, right? I mean, you could say right now I'm a book designer. That's quite specialized. Mm-hmm. In amongst the world of designers, even it's a specialty, and design is a specialty in the world of, you know, all the things that you can do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it does cover a lot of ground. So it depends on your point of view, how specialized it is. You know, when I'm in a meeting like an AIGA meeting or something, you know, I can talk differently about what I do as a book designer than if I'm in a, let's say, a general business networking meeting or something, where people are, you know, like I was, you know, oh, books are designed? I had no idea.
Right.
It is a tough, tough area to really resolve. And I'm not sure there is really one that's better or worse. I think the world has to have both kinds of people. In some ways, being a specialist is easier. In as much as, you know, anything you want to do that's worth doing is going to be some hard work. Mm-hmm. But it's easier in the sense that it's easier to talk about what you do. That helps not just at cocktail parties, but it helps also when you're trying to brand yourself. You know, and right. So when you're doing marketing, the more specific you can be about exactly what it is you do, it's far, far easier to get, you know, the SEO rankings, to get a website that makes sense to exactly the person that wants to hire exactly what you do. Mm-hmm. As a generalist, that is much, much harder. However, I think naturally we all are more generalists. And I think you tend to see, as people progress in their careers, they tend to move from a specialty into more of a generality, because they understand more of how the world works. Mm-hmm. And you realize that if you're not desperate to find clients through like SEO hits or ads or things like that, but if it's more word of mouth, mm-hmm. The generalist comes out stronger, because you're able to help people in more ways than just the one specific silo that you work in. Mm-hmm. And they remember that, and they tell their friends that, or they tell, you know, their colleagues or their even their competitors about that. Mm-hmm. And that allows you to kind of spread more organically. I don't know. To me, Chris, it's kind of it's the hammer problem, if you will. You know, the saying that if all you have is a hammer, then every problem tends to look like a nail.
Right.
I see that very much as, you know, the specialist is the hammer. And I've heard people say, well, you know, if you have to have brain surgery, you know, wouldn't you want a specialist brain surgeon instead of a GP? And it's mm-hmm. like, well, yeah, I would. But if I'm not sure what's wrong with me, I don't want to talk to a brain surgeon right away, because I'm pretty sure their recommendation is going to be brain surgery.
Right.
And that may not be, it may just be, I need to, you know, cut back on the sugary donuts or something, right? It might not necessarily involve cracking my skull open.
Right.
And that's the way that I think there's, you know, there are places for both things, you know, and even if you want to say what I do now is somewhat of a generalist, you know, I understand a lot about print technology and, you know, what goes into actually the manufacturing of a printed book, but I don't generally do that myself, not on a high, you know, mass scale. I hire somebody to do it. I hire a printer to do it. I hire a specialist. So there always has to be some give and take with that.
Right.
And I think, you know, the same thing, you know, could be said about me. You know, if an author is looking to create a book and they don't want to do it themselves, then they will either hire or get picked up by a publisher. And a publisher is in some sense a generalist in the publishing world. And they hire specialists like me to design the book, or they hire a specialist who's an editor to edit the book. You know, so it works at all those different levels. But for me personally, yeah, I think if I get to the point where I really, this is going to sound funny, but if I get to the point where I really understand what I'm doing, it's lost interest for me and I need to move to something else. The great thing for me about book design, which is why I think this is probably where I'll be now for the rest of my career, no more big pivots. Well, you never know, but I don't anticipate any, because I'm always learning new things in book design. You know, there's certainly, you know, print technology, you know, typography, that's an ever, you know, evergreen kind of field to be studying. But also from my clients, you know, from the authors, I'm learning about all sorts of new things. And that's pretty cool in and of itself. So
I bet.
And that just, you know, that just adds to that general mindset, that general knowledge base that I have. It gets me that much closer to understanding how everything works.
That's right. And then you can talk about new electrons and quarks to your clients.
Yes. Well, and the great thing about that, so quarks, okay, there's six known quarks. They come in three varieties, there's in different families, but each quark can take on, you know, like an electron has a charge, right? Negative charge, minus one, if you will. And a proton has a positive charge, plus one. Well, quarks don't have that kind of, well, they do have that kind of charge. It's fractional charge, but they also have something that's known as a colored charge. Quarks can be red, green, or blue. And the great thing is when you put three quarks together, you get white, you get neutrality, which is the way things like to be in the universe, neutral, stable. So just like you could have a negative electron orbiting a positive proton, net charge is zero. You have three quarks, which is what makes up each nucleon, like a proton, two ups and a down, that each have one color, and the colors cancel out or balance out. So there's a connection between graphic design and physics.
Yeah. Red, green, blue, right there. RGB, RGB. All the way on results in white.
Yeah. Or neutral colors.
Yeah. My mind is blown right now.
Yeah. And back in my physics days, we talked about, you know, there was color physics. I mean, we talk about that. There's actually a field of it. It's known as quantum chromodynamics. Chromo, color. Quantum color physics.
All connected.
It is all connected in a very strange way. Now, I'll admit, I don't use quantum chromodynamics very often in my design practice.
Well, speaking of your practice, your company name is Illustrata, and I'm curious what the significance of that word means for you.
Well, Illustrata. So I started Illustrata 10 years ago now, and as anybody who started a company knows, one of the biggest challenges to picking a name for your company is finding a website, finding the URL that's actually available. And so I don't even know how many different combinations of things I was trying. You know, many didn't work. And I hit on this notion of the word illustrate, you know, which we know, or what we typically think of in English is, you know, somebody drawing pictures. You know, they're an illustrator. Or the software from Adobe Illustrator. But illustrate actually has a Latin origin. It's the same word as illustrate, but also illuminate, you know, that same sort of idea. And the basic foundation of that in Latin is to explain. That I felt was at the heart of the business that I thought I was starting 10 years ago, which would be in content marketing, actually. That's what I was thinking I'd start out in. And so this notion of, you know, what my job was to explain things to people. And so to illustrate or this made up word, Illustrata, seemed to make sense for that. And the URL was available. So I snatched it up and stuck with it. it's actually very close, I think, to the Portuguese word for illustrate. I think that's one L maybe. But yeah, I stuck with that, with Illustrata. It's a curious name. It's mm-hmm. it's perhaps not the best choice of names, because I do get a lot of people that, especially when I talk about book design, they assume I'm an illustrator, like a children's book illustrator.
Oh, okay.
And I'm definitely not. But it does give me the opportunity to tell the story about illustrate means to explain. And
yeah, that's awesome.
That's a big part of, you know, the books that I do, you know, since I do a lot of nonfiction books, you know, by and large, they are out there to explain something. So,
yeah. Oh, I love that the root of illustrate is to explain. I didn't know that.
It's kind of very meta, because I have to explain it.
Exactly. Oh, that's interesting.
That's the origin of Illustrata. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So what is your design process when you take an idea and turn it into a finished product?
Oh, yeah. I always think of that cartoon of the scientists at the big giant chalkboard with the lots of equations and you know, and a miracle happens written somewhere in the middle of that. It's like there's always a bit of that.
Yes.
But
so true.
But my design process really starts sometimes to the annoyance of my clients with a lot of questions. I really want to understand what their vision is. Right? You know, so if it's in the context of a book, you know, what their vision of the book is. And so if I can have the manuscript, even a early edit of it, that helps. I don't usually read the whole manuscript, but I'll certainly skim it. It gives me a sense of it. But I want to hear from them what they're thinking about. Books are curious in the sense that, you know, you've got the cover. That's a marketing piece, 100%. That's what a cover does. It's about marketing. The interior, the guts of the book, have a very different purpose and a very different feel to them. But they ought to work together. I think they ought to work together, at least. And so it's talking to the author or the editor, if it's at a publisher, to understand what's the vision for this book. And I tend to use big words like that, you know, vision or mission or plan, because I don't want to bias them too much. But it gets down to understanding what are the comparables in the industry? What are other books that are like this book that are out there? What do they look like? What do we need this book to look like so that it looks like it fits in the genre, but it doesn't fit too much in the genre because you want it to stand out. But you don't want to stand out too much because then readers don't really know what the book is about. And in particular, book buyers at bookstores won't know how to classify it. So all of that kind of has to get rolled together. So it's a discussion process. We do some visuals sometimes. You know, I'll ask them if they have favorite books that are, you know, that have things that they like. Most authors are not visual thinkers. Many are, but most are not. And so it helps to kind of transition them into this visual world. But at the same time, for them to understand that the idea that they have for what the cover should be, many times authors come with an idea, may not be the best way to sell their book. Oftentimes, you see this with self-published books all the time. They try to cram so much into the cover. You know, they want to tell the whole story right there on the cover. And that's just, it doesn't work.
You know, usually in the subtitle.
Yeah, well, that happens. Yeah. That is definitely the era of the subtitle that we're in. So getting them to kind of back off from that, doing a little bit of my explaining, you know, because I love the notion of, you know, talking about gestalt in visual, how visuals work, and getting them to understand that less is actually more. It's much more powerful, and powerful is good because it attracts attention. Attention is good because it leads to book sales, and that's ultimately what you want in selling a product. And then usually that exhausts them enough that I don't really have to explain much about the interior. You're just like, do what you want, Paul. I trust you. But, you know, it depends on the type of book. You know, for a novel, you know, a fiction type book or a memoir that has a few pictures, interior is very straightforward. There's not a lot to talk about there. For, let's say, a little bit heavier kind of nonfiction book, you know, a guidebook or a workbook or, you know, something that's not quite textbook, but more in that direction, that gets much more involved. You got more levels of heading. You have different types. You know, maybe have pull quotes. You have examples, citations, all this kind of stuff that need to be, you know, formatted in a certain way, so that the reader naturally understands what's happening and doesn't see the design. And that's you know, that's kind of that weird arc of what, as a book designer that does both covers and interiors, I have to bring people through and ultimately bring the reader through is that I want to grab their attention, let them know what's going to happen, tease their curiosity, tease their interest with the cover, mm-hmm. let them open the book. And then as a designer, I need to get out of the way. I need to let them enjoy the story. And if they notice it's designed, except in rare circumstances, I've probably done something wrong because it means they've tripped. It means something wasn't formatted correctly. And of course, being designed in a way that isn't noticed is a lot harder than being designed in a way that is noticed. So interiors are actually much harder than covers, even though most people don't realize they're actually designed at all. So it's kind of, you know, explaining that process and all the while bringing ideas forward. So typically with a cover, I'll do several samples just because that's kind of what the industry expects. You know, I need three covers to look at and I choose somewhere between the first and the second, but modify it and grab something from the third. I mean, that's kind of the general gist of how cover layout works. And that's fine. I think it's fun for me. I don't mind developing multiple independent concepts. Mm-hmm. And then I like to, this is something that's a little different for me. I like to have meetings, you know, with whoever's making the decision and the author, if possible, mm-hmm. about, you know, kind of do a presentation of the different covers so that we can talk about them and together agree on what does or doesn't work well, what they were thinking, what they weren't thinking, and try to, from that, then formulate a single design that then gets finalized.
Wow.
But, you know, it doesn't always go smoothly. But I try to make it go well. Yeah. The thing with a book design, you know, like an ad design, a product design, that's difficult. And you're dealing with, you know, generally speaking, you know, especially if it's a big company or a big brand, you know, you're dealing with a lot of money, a lot of committees maybe are involved in it. But ultimately, it's just a product. A book, however, is somebody's baby. I mean, somebody poured a lot of their life into creating this book. Mm-hmm. You know, any book takes multiple years to write, I think. And, you know, they need to know it's being handled well. They need to know that they're handing it to somebody that will care for it as much as they have, or maybe even a little more. And that's, you know, I think part of the process of design as well is getting that trust established so mm-hmm. that there can be honesty. And, you know, it ultimately comes down to that. And, you know, I've had it where authors say, you know, I'd really like to have this on the cover. And I'm like, you really don't want that on the cover. It's not a good idea. And, you know, having the author say, okay, I trust you on this. Let's leave it off. So that's kind of the process, though. But, you know, as far as what I do internally, then it's creating a lot of different sketches myself. I do a lot of sketching. I try to do sketching with you know, paper and pencil. Mm-hmm. I try not to involve the computer too early because the computer tends to lead to too much pixel perfection. But I have to bring it into the computer generally to show clients. They don't really want to see a, you know, 1-inch tall cover. Because I'll do that. I'll like fill a page of my notebook with 1-inch tall versions of the cover. You know, just really crude typography, you know, stick figures, things like that. I know exactly what it means, but, you know, anybody would look at that and say, oh my God, we paid this guy to do it.
Exactly.
we need to hire a junior high kid or something because this is not good. So I got to make it look a little better. But that helps. It helps to get the ideas out, you know, and then, you know, set it aside, you know, look at it the next day or a couple of days later and say, you know, crap, get rid of all those ideas. And, you know, really start kind of winnowing it down before I even show, you know, anybody else what I think the idea should be. And so by the time I'm starting to formulate them in the computer, they're fairly well developed and there's pretty good reasons. There's intentionality behind all of the elements of them. And that then leads to, you know, some deeper discussions.
Right.
Because everybody assumes, you know, you just, you know, all artists, it comes out of your brain fully formed and ready.
And, it does? And, what?
And, yeah. And it's just done on a whim because, you know, all artists are kind of, you know, flighty characters anyhow or something. You know? So it's like, no, there's actually a process. This is serious. And I actually have reasons why the type looks just the way it does. And no, we can't do it in that font because that is the wrong message. You don't want to say that.
You know, it's interesting. You are mentioning a lot that it's a very serious process, but you also have said throughout this interview just how much fun it is for you. And I love that tension between serious and fun.
Apparently so do I, because I keep doing it. Yeah. No, it is important. I mean, being a creative is a wonderful job. I mean, it truly is. It, when you get to create as a creative, I should say, is a wonderful job. And it means there are some highs of people, you know, saying, I like your design. Woo! They like my design. And there's lows where they say, this is awful. And it's like, no, actually, it's really good, but okay, I get it. You don't like it. You know, yeah. You gotta kind of, you know, take it as you can. But there's a lot of, especially in book design, there's a lot of what I might call more the production design stuff. I mean, there's a lot of technical stuff as well. Mm-hmm. You know, typography is wonderful and fun, but it's also very mechanical and algorithmic. There are things you have to do because that is how things are done. Mm-hmm. And they are done that way because that is how the brain works when it processes and converts words into ideas. And you can't deviate because it just doesn't work as well. It's not what people are expecting. It will confuse them, and you don't want to confuse people. You know, so there's things like that are happening as well. And that's always intention. And it's like any project. I mean, you know, it's a creative project. It's beautiful. It's colorful. It's vibrant. It's fun. But it's also creating a product, and it's going to be manufactured, and it has to meet, you know, technical requirements. It has to meet marketing requirements. It has to do all of that kind of stuff. There are meetings, there are memos, there are things that have to happen in order to make sure it does take place. You know, it is a profession in that sense. And I think that's something that, since I'm kind of on that topic, you know, I think it's something that is maybe misrepresented. And I think this is true of artists. I also consider myself an artist in some of what I do. It is part art, but it is also part engineering. Mm-hmm. And you do have to have both parts. And anybody that is an artist is also a business person, and you have to have the business side of it. There has to be some business acumen. I mean, if you can't make money at what you're doing, then you have to get another funding source, because there has to be some way to pay for life. Life costs money. And you know, if you're, you know, back in the Renaissance era and you have a, you know, a patron who's able to put you up and pay you to do things, great. Not many people had that opportunity.
Right.
So otherwise, you're trying to figure out how to make ends meet by still maintaining your artistic integrity and hopefully not screwing up too much when you actually produce them.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's a balance. It's a tension.
So, Paul, if you went back in time, because, you know, as someone...
I love time travel. Let me just tell you, I love time travel.
I mean, if there's anyone that I've talked to that could figure it out, it's you. So if you could travel back in time to your younger version of yourself, and you told him that you would be an entrepreneur and book designer one day, how would he have responded?
Okay, first of all, I have to say I do regularly time travel. It is one of the perks of having a PhD in physics. You're actually allowed to do that.
That's awesome.
And I can tell you, my younger self would have nothing to do with my older self. It'd be like, look, man, I can figure it out myself. I know what I'm doing. Because that's how I was when I was younger. I would not have taken my own advice. The thing I think I would really try to impress on myself is that to, I guess, be willing to be flexible about what you're doing and where you're going with things. Mm-hmm. And don't let the current moment or what you think are other people's perceptions get in the way of what you really want to do. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't have to go back very far in time, Chris, to have that advice be useful advice to give myself. I mean, I could, yesterday would be good. Yesterday would be good on that. But I think that's the kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I was very, I questioned authority. In fact, I had a button that I wore on my, I used to wear vests. I wear vests again, but in high school, I wore vests a lot. And I had a big button that said questioned authority. And I was quite proud to be wearing that around amongst all my teachers and things like that.
I love that mental picture right there. I mean, that's just so fantastic because I can see it clearly. He's walking down the hall, question authority.
Uh-huh.
That's great.
Yeah, that was definitely my point of view. And, you know, I got away with a lot. It was a time of great freedom, I think, and great fun. I don't think kids have nearly the freedom today because...
I agree.
I mean, this was pre-internet when I was in high school. So it was, you know, there was a lot more freedom.
So, do you think you'll one day write a book and design it yourself?
Hmm. oh, would I want to work for myself? That would be a tough, tough client to have. So I have. So in addition to the trade book, commercial book design, I'm also a book artist. So I make hand-printed, hand-bound books. And so I have actually created a book, several books, but one in particular that was a book of photographs that I had done along with my own words with it, kind of a cool poetry, poetic reflection on isolation. And this was pre-COVID even. That's the title of the book. But I think you're talking about more of like a book you could find on Amazon.
Sure. I mean, I that's really fascinating to know that, you know, you've combined your photos with words. I think that's fascinating too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and hand printing is that's the fine press world. So that's the other kind of, you know, I guess you want to talk about generalities for a second. That's the other kind of broad part. I don't just design covers. I also do interiors. I don't just do interiors. I also do, I don't just do interiors of commercially produced books. I also do hand-printed books. And that gives me, again, a better understanding of how books work and how to assemble them. It sometimes drives printers nuts because I know an awful lot about how books are actually made, and I know what is technically possible, even if they don't necessarily want to do it. But writing a book, now that's a lot of work. And that truly is a lot of work. I would like to someday, and I think, well, I definitely think I could. The question is if I would have something to write about that I feel strongly enough to dedicate that much time to. But certainly if I did, I would want to design it myself, because I would not wish myself on any designer to do that kind of stuff. And I think you see that when designers do create their own books, you know, books about design or books about typography, you know, they're able to do their own books, probably to the annoyance of their publishers.
Exactly.
But, you know, they create things that are not normal. They're not standard, and they're that much more beautiful because of that. And that's, I think, you know, as a designer, especially as a book designer, but I think in general, designers like to read, or at least own, those kind of books, the ones that have been, you know, self-designed, just because they are able to push things a little bit further. Right. And that would be fun, but it has to be the right kind of topic. And and so, you know, I'm not sure at this point what I would even write about. So stay tuned.
Excellent. Well, last question for you, Paul. What book is currently blowing your mind right now?
That's so hard to answer. Because I love so many books, and so many books have had such influence on me, even the ones that I don't ever actually read. And that's the great thing about being a book designer, is I can legitimately buy a book just because I like the cover and call it a business expense.
Yes.
You know, there's a couple that come to mind right now, though. One that I've been reading by James Victori is Effect for Function.
Yes.
If you say that correctly. That's a really interesting book. I think there's some unfortunate typography choices in there. Add that. This is one that James is a designer, designed it himself. But it's a beautiful book, beautiful notion. And unfortunately, poor construction. The cover fell off my copy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I don't think it was intended. I mean, you know, the whole idea about, you know, trying to get away from perfection, which is something that I think many designers such as myself always struggle with. You know, the fact that the cover fell off is kind of a, you know, it's really kind of a cool thing, but I don't think it was intended.
Right. Yeah, that's wild.
But that's a really good book. You know, another one I would mention that I just love, and this is, you know, the irony of, you know, literally doing typography every single day, yet I still buy typography books because they're so cool.
Yeah.
One that I picked up very recently is called Inside Paragraphs, Typographic Fundamentals. It's a little book written, good book, can be little. It's written by a fellow by the name of Cyrus Highsmith. And I met him through the Type at Cooper lecture series, which they do online. Anybody that's interested in typography, I highly encourage you. They're free. They're done on Zoom. And it's the folks that are in the type design department at Cooper Hewitt in New York.
Wow.
Anyhow, so this book, Inside Paragraphs, is just, it's a beautifully done book. Of course, he designed it himself. It's a beautifully done book, though, in that I think that the underlying story is not about the type. It's about the negative space. It's about the space between the type. And that is such an important part of understanding how typesetting and typography works, is to see the space between the letters. Of course, that's true of all visual arts. I mean, all of us that are in the visual arts spend a great deal of time learning to see and continuing to see negative space, not mm-hmm. not the subject, everything else. Mm-hmm. Photographers, you know, it's fundamental to a good photograph. You know, anybody can get a good portrait. It's what's in the background, what's happening around them, that's hard to see, hard to do simultaneously with getting a good portrait. You know, so that part from a typographic standpoint, Cyrus does an excellent job of explaining it and demonstrating it. And it's, even if you understand everything about typography, I would say get his book just because it's marvelous to see it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. This has been so illuminating. I've enjoyed every single moment of it. Thank you for how you show up and educate and entertain with just the way you are. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed talking. This was enlightening for me too, just to see how I answer your questions.
Well, we'll do this again good tomorrow. Question. We'll see if they're the same.
There we go. Answers. Yeah, that'd be a good test. Oh boy.
In case you didn't hear the previous monologue where I talked about Curiosity Builders, I started a community for creators, dreamers, storytellers, and do-gooders who need a safe space to dig deeper into who they are and what they care about. You can head to curiosity.builders or find the link in the show notes at gwtw.co/544 to join this free community. I hope I'll see you there. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.